and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximize your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome to the show, Christy Ashwanden. Have I pronounced that right?
You did. In fact, you did, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Christy. I asked you on the show because I love the title of your new book. I'm going to let you tell the readers about the title. But I love the fact that you have focused on recovery. As a coach, I've got 25 years of experience and working in the triathlon field mostly. And in general, when people want to up their game, they're asking me about how do they increase their training. I can't recall any conversation where somebody has come to me and said, please, Simon, can you help me improve my recovery to get the most out of the training I'm currently doing? So I'm really pleased that somebody's taken the lead and written a book completely about recovery. So please tell the listeners what your book's called, where they can find it, and we'll put that in the show notes at the end.
Sure. So it's called Good to Go. And the subtitle actually varies depending on which edition you're reading. The U.S. version, the subtitle is What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. But the U.K. edition, which is put out by Macmillan, in the U.S. it's a Norton book. But in the U.K. it is How to Eat, Sleep, and Rest Like a Champion. So kind of interesting little publication fact there that little tweaks. And the cover is actually quite different for the two of them as well. But the book contents are the same. And it's really a book, like it says, about recovery.
Great. Well, what was your, I've just sort of given you, you know, why I think it's such a good idea, but what was your inspiration for writing the book in the first place?
Yeah, so I guess I should start with a little bit about my background. I was a runner in high school and college. I've actually sort of been a lifelong runner. It's something I continue to do to this day. I also began cycling in college, and I was a pretty serious road cyclist for a while. And then I also started Nordic skiing, and that was probably the sport I took to the highest level. I traveled all over the world racing for Team Rosignol, as a Nordic ski racer. And so those were the three sports that I did. But during my athletic career, you know, as I look back now that I'm done with elite sport anyway, I can sort of recognize that the thing that limited sort of my potential and the thing that I never managed to get right back when I was competing seriously was recovery. And it's something that, you know, I sort of wish that I knew then what I knew now. And I've often heard it said that writers should write what they know, but I wrote the book that I wish I had back then.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty certain that there'd be a lot of people who are saying, you know, if I'd only known that more sleep would be beneficial. I'm fairly certain there'll be people listening to this go, yeah, if only I knew more sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's a great start. And as I say, I'm over the moon. As soon as I saw the title of this book, I thought, I need to get that lady on this show because she, my current line of thinking is all about probably what's a reverse way of approaching training to what most coaches do or athletes, whereas they try and fit the training in and then work out when things aren't going right, how to build in more recovery and more rest and better nutrition. I'm trying to take a different approach and think, right, how can we get the right recovery in place? How can we get the right nutrition in place? Right, how can we get all of those things in the strength and conditioning and the mobility? And then
with the time we've got left, let's put the training in there, layering on top. And my hunch, and I think I'm starting to see some results from this, is that actually the overall result will be less training, more attention to recovery and nutrition equals a better results in the short term and better long-term health for our athletes, which probably is more important.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that, one of the traditional ways of looking at training has been, wanting to optimize the amount that you're getting and basically, with the goal of training as much as humanly possible. But I think that that's really backwards thinking. And if you sort of look at the science and the research here, really what you want to be doing, I mean, the purpose of training is not just to, get ticks on your training log. And, now it's interesting because people are using all these things like Strava and they can share their training logs online with friends. And so people can really sort of compare notes and see what everyone's doing. But the goal of training is not just to log hours. It is to spur adaptations. I mean, you're doing that training in hopes of getting fitter and faster. And so, the goal of the training then should not be just to rack up hours, but to do sort of the minimum amount of training you need to spur those adaptations. You want to be able to go into your events well rested and ready to perform, not tired because, you went out to get another hour on the training log to hit whatever goal that you had. You really want to sort of do the minimum amount that you can do to get those benefits that you're looking for.
It's interesting you say that about what, let's call it minimum effective dose, because I've had conversations with several elite coaches in the UK, all of whom have worked with Olympic champions and have a long, credible CV for working with athletes. And yet, in the face of this evidence, which comes from our best coaches, the athletes who are the weekend warriors are looking at that and saying, yeah, but that's all right for them to say that I'm different. So I need to do as much training as physically possible. And these are guys who have jobs and stress. And I'm sure we're going to talk about stress and the fact that stress doesn't need to just come from training. It comes from everywhere in our daily lives. But you're really echoing what these elite coaches have said, is if you find the minimum prescription for exercise that's going to create some improvement, that's what you should be doing.
Absolutely. And, my book has an entire chapter devoted to the phenomenon of overtraining, which is a huge problem. And one thing that I noticed and that I saw while researching the book is that overtraining is not just a problem that afflicts, the really elite or professional athletes. It's also quite common among, working professionals who are also, doing sport, somewhat seriously, and they're going after that. And, a lot of it comes down to not understanding this idea about the minimum effective dose, but also sort of approaching the whole idea of training with sort of the incorrect, approach, which is trying to just cram everything in instead of really thinking and paying attention to how your body is responding to the training. I mean, that training response, the response that you're getting from that training that you're doing, should really be the guide to what you're doing. And when you aren't responding anymore, or you're responding to more training with just fatigue that you can't recover from, that's a sign that you've gone too far and need to back off. But too often what happens is athletes find themselves in this state and they think, oh, if I'm not responding, that means I need to push harder. And that's how people really dig themselves into the hole.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned adaptation there, because I had a conversation with Joe Friel recently, and he was talking about how adaptation and recovery are different. So recovery is the ability to get over a session and be prepared for the next one. But adaptation is really that process where the body sort of regenerates and rebuilds itself and actually moves forward. And there is a distinct difference between the two.
Yeah, but I mean, adaptation is what happens during recovery. Adaptation does not happen during the training itself. And that's adaptation is the reason that recovery is so important. It's, what allows your body to get fitter, faster, stronger in response to training. It's what allows you to be prepared for the next bout of exercise, whether it's training or an event. And so those adaptations, I mean, that's what, you're giving your body the space and time and energy that it needs to do those things while you are recovering and while you're in the recovery state. And this is why, I think in some ways, really, it's helpful to think of recovery as sort of an extension of training. So not something that's distinct or different, but part of that process and that needs to be sort of given the same respect and the same time, almost like penciling it into your training program in the same way that, that training itself is.
I've told this story on a number of occasions now, but I was an MC at a workshop that Chrissy Wellington was involved with, and somebody put their hand up and asked her how many hours of training she did each week when she was, you know, competing in Ironman. And she said, 168. And the person looked at her and then did a quick math sum and thought, oh, hold on. He said, that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And she said, yes, everything I do in that day was geared towards my training. It's not separate. So that was included riding my bike, sleeping, mobility, getting my physio, going shopping for the right foods. It was all part of that whole mix that contributed to my elite performance. Mm-hmm. Quite profound. Okay. So, Christy, in your book and in the foreword, you talk about one of the driving forces was to try to debunk the junk. So I thought that we could start by looking at some of the recovery, I use sort of inverted commas when I mentioned that there, that the recovery methods that people are currently using that perhaps aren't as good as the marketing tells us they are. So what recovery trends did you discover that are currently popular that really are nothing more than good marketing?
Well, where to begin? I mean, I guess the short answer is most of them, to be honest.
Oh, dear.
I think maybe the better approach here is to take a step back and say, you know, what is it that, that really matters? And I think one of the big takeaways from my book is that at its most basic level, recovery is actually quite simple. And so much of the marketing out there right now is really trying to convince us that it's, you know, more complicated than we would otherwise think, that we, you know, need to spend money or spend time too. Some of these things are really about, doing things, you know, at its most basic level, recovery is rest and rejuvenation. You know, it's rest and, you know, taking a break. And so anything that you're doing is, you know, sort of runs the risk of becoming its own source of stress. So let me just sort of explain what I mean by that. Yeah, back when I was a serious athlete, recovery, we really sort of thought of it as something you did in between workouts. It was just literally resting. And so there weren't things that we were doing. I mean, we didn't have foam rollers back then. We didn't have these massage devices and all of these different things. We did do massage and we did do a lot of these things. They weren't completely foreign at that point. But what's really happened now is recovery has become this thing that in some cases, and I document this in my book, I talk about a few athletes. There's one guy that I write about who is a very serious runner, training for the 1 mile event on the track. And he ends up spending in a typical day more time on his recovery doing these various things than he does actually running. And I think when you get into that kind of situation, you have to wonder, you know, whether all of that running around and doing these things is becoming, you know, instead of a source of rest and recovery, is really becoming a source of stress. And so many of these products that are being marketed to people now, there's also this underlying sort of urgency and this one thing that I noticed is that so much of the marketing really capitalizes on this thing. It's often called FOMO. Fear of missing out, where there's this idea that, you know, oh, you could just really get recovery just perfect if only you did, you know, all of these things correctly and use the right devices, and no one wants to miss out. But what I found in my research is that so many of these things are really, if they are offering any benefits, and in most cases, they probably really aren't. But even when they are, the benefits are going to be small compared to what you could get from other things. And so if you are expending energy and stress in order to attain these things or to do them, you know, it's very easy to get in a situation where it's sort of canceling each other out and you're not getting an overall benefit from it. I mean, there's a reason I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to sleep, because sleep is the most powerful recovery tool known to science. Nothing else. I mean, you could take every single thing that's out there marketed for recovery and add them all together and it wouldn't even come close to sleep. And so I just have to laugh when I see these athletes who are skimping on sleep And yet, you know, spending all this time and energy on all of these other things that, you know, put together are just not going to offer the benefits that they could get from just regular good night's sleep.
It seems to me that this is part of this modern phenomena disease, if you like, that we need to try and hack things. We need to try and get stuff done quickly. So if we could get 8 hours sleep done in 4 hours, that would be better, because then we could fit more training into the other 4 hours we save, which would be slightly ironic. But you know, if there was an app that we could wear, or something we could put on our head, or something that we could sleep inside that was going to give us the benefits of 12 hours worth of sleep in 8. But, you know, it seems every time I talk to somebody about this, whether it's a coach or a scientist or somebody like yourself that's done the research into the various different methods, it does come back to the basic simple principles that sleep and good nutrition are probably the most powerful contributors, learning how to manage stress and learning how to listen to your body.
Absolutely. I mean, those are the big takeaways of my book. And, you know, I do have an entire chapter about sleep. And I think sleep is interesting because, like I said, it's the most powerful recovery tool, but it's also something that can be really difficult for people to get right, you know, but what's interesting is that it's actually pretty simple to get it right. And the thing that where people go astray is that they fail to prioritize sleep. And in the book, I talk about this new phenomenon that researchers have given a name to that's called sleep procrastination, which is basically what happens, you know, in our modern world today. Most people do not have the luxury of being able to sleep in and just wake up in the morning whenever they feel like it. Like, they have, at some point, they need to get up and go to work or take care of their children, whatever it is that their particular needs are. But what this means is that, you know, if you're going to get enough sleep, you have to go to bed soon enough. You can't stay up too late. And what happens now is we have all of these distractions and all of these things, you know, our phones, Netflix, all of these things that are sort of vying for our attention. And it's very easy to, you know, when your time is up, when it's time to go to bed, to get your 8 hours of sleep or whatever, to just say, well, I'm just going to watch one more episode of this show that I'm watching, or, well, I'm just going to check my email really quickly. And I think we all know that there's no such thing as quickly checking your email, because you open your email and you sort of fall into the abyss, right? And the next thing you know, you're an hour late to bed.
The ironic thing about all this, Christy, is that Netflix and email, all of these things are on devices which can be almost put on pause. I mean, you can watch Netflix anytime. It's not like, you know, 20 years ago when you didn't have catch up on TV and we had video recorder where we had to go through the tape and find the bit where we wanted. We can pause a program on Netflix, and when we go on the next day, it asks if we want to resume from where we left off. So, you know, if we go to bed half an hour early, that program or that episode that we were watching is still going to be there, and we can catch up on it a bit earlier. And it feels like all we need to do is take a bit more of a look into our time management and think, right, I'm going to have my dinner here. I'm going to make sure the kids are in bed. Then I'm going to have an hour, but that hour's got to finish at 9 p.m. so then I can get into my sleep routine and get into bed at 9:30, relaxed and ready to go and get my zeds.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think that this also goes back to this idea, you know, we're living in a society now where we're sort of told that everything can be optimized, and there's this ideal version of ourselves that's out there just waiting to be hacked into. And, like, you know, if only we do these quick little things and these shortcuts, we can get to this better version of ourselves. But I think that, you know, anytime someone's sort of making that kind of promise, you have to take a step back and ask, you know, I feel like most of us have a pretty good built-in sort of bullshit detector. Like, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And so, you know, you can worry about these hacks, or you can just sort of stick to the basics. And I think that one of the dangers here is that we feel like we have to be productive all the time, but recovery is really about resting and relaxing. And we're almost at a moment where we've lost the ability to truly relax. So it's not even like we can't even just like watch the show. We have to keep watching. Instead of, you know, we've sort of lost the ability to do nothing and to just let our minds wander and to have this feeling of having unstructured time where our bodies can be, you know, really at ease, our minds can be at ease. We don't have this pressure and feeling like we need to be doing something.
So come on, I'm going to put you on the spot, Christy. Is Did you actually find any recovery methods that people are using which really don't contribute to recovery at all?
Yeah, so I think one of the ones that really surprised me is icing. This is one that's really popular. I used to do it when I was a cyclist during stage races in particular. We would always, you know, fill up a bathtub with ice and get into these ice baths. And I'll just say that they're really painful. So it feels like, you know, they must really be doing something powerful. But it turns out that icing does not help with recovery. And in fact, it may even impair it, at least in the sense of helping with adaptations. And so there's a little bit of research that suggests perhaps if you are icing in between, you know, events on the track or something for very short-term recovery, might be a little bit helpful. It's sort of by numbing your muscles, it can potentially help, but it's not something that you want to be doing during a training camp or at any time when, you know, you're training hard and that recovery that you're doing is really with an eye towards adaptations. And so there's even some evidence that there are some clever studies that they've done where they would take people and put them on a hard exercise program, and then they would ice one limb or the other. So maybe your right leg got ice, but not your left one. And what they found is that they actually had fewer adaptations in the limb that was iced. And even they found things sort of at the protein level of, you know, some physiological things, physiological differences that could be pinned down. And so not only did it not help recovery, it seemed to actually potentially hinder it.
I suppose one of the processes of training is that we get inflammation and,
right.
The icing will get in the way of the inflammation then. And that's sort of where, I suppose, where it hinders the recovery process.
That's right. And I'm glad you mentioned inflammation, because this is another thing. It's so interesting. So many of the recovery tools and things that are being marketed really hinge on inflammation. And a lot of the claims are about reducing inflammation, but that's exactly the opposite of what you want. Inflammation is your friend. I mean, it's part of your body's healing process, and it is part of the reason you get fitter, faster, stronger in response to training. You know, that inflammatory process is essential for adaptations, and it's essential for helping your muscles get stronger. It's essential for repairing any damage that is done during hard exercise. And so you don't want to eliminate or reduce inflammation. You know, you don't necessarily want to be going around all the time. You know, if you're out running and you sprain your ankle, no one likes having an enormous ankle that's all swollen. But for the most part, inflammation is really, you know, it's something that's helpful, that it shouldn't be something that you're trying to reduce.
I suppose it's somewhat ironic that a lot of endurance athletes reward themselves with pizza or cake,
yeah,
or beer when they've been training. And these are foods that we know are actually, you know, produce inflammatory responses in the muscles. So maybe one of the things that we should be looking at is how we can improve our nutrition to reduce those inflammatory responses, and then forget the gimmicky anti-inflammatory processes that you've just mentioned.
Yeah, and I think another thing that comes up here that I think is worth thinking about is anti-inflammatory drugs. I'm speaking specifically about, they're usually termed NSAIDs for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. These are things like ibuprofen, which athletes very often like to take almost prophylactically, where they're saying, well, I'm going out for a long, hard run, and I know I'm going to get kind of sore, so I'm going to take this ahead of time to prevent that. It turns out that taking something like ibuprofen won't actually reduce soreness. There's some pretty good research on this now that it does not reduce muscle soreness. But it also seems to potentially impair the healing process and impair these adaptations that I was just talking about that involve inflammation. And so you really want to avoid using these things if you're an athlete. There are times and places to use them, and that is, you know, they're really good they're really good painkillers, and there are times when you really need these. You know, I find that for a headache, nothing solves it for me like ibuprofen, and that's an appropriate situation to use it. But what's not helpful is to be just sort of popping it willy-nilly in hopes of staving off things or in hopes of, you know, reducing muscle soreness and whatnot. It really should be used very judiciously.
You've mentioned the research that you looked at to determine whether these recovery methods were useful or not. For the people who are listening to this podcast, how do they know when they're looking at, for example, the British press, probably like the American press, are fond of saying, you know, if you drink sweet drinks, that's going to be more likely to cause cancer. If you have one glass of red wine a night, it's going to reduce the effects of cancer. If you do this, it's going to help you recover quicker. But how does the average person who doesn't have that sort of formal education background and ability to understand research data, how do they know what they can trust? Where can they go to find information they can trust, and how can they determine which is the sort of gimmicky research and which actually have some credibility?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it can be pretty tricky, actually. I wish that there was a really simple trick, but it gets complicated. I will say a few things, though. One is that I think there's a lot of really bad nutrition research out there. I actually wrote a story when I was at 538. The headline was something like, you can't trust what you read about nutrition studies, or you can't trust nutrition studies, something like that, nutrition headlines. But the story was all about some sort of inherent limitations in the way that many of these nutrition studies are done. The first of which is that the data are self-reported. And so, most of the data are collected using these instruments and these tools in which they basically ask people to recall the foods that they've been eating. And even if you have a population that is doing their very best to answer correctly, it could be really, really tricky to get accurate data. So I'll just ask you, Simon, a typical question would be something like, in the past 6 months, how often did you eat tomatoes, and how large of a serving would you eat?
Probably have tomatoes, or tomatoes, as we call them over here. I probably have them most days, either in my omelette or my salad. So I like the little cherry tomatoes because they're easy to cook and prepare. So it'd probably be, a cupful over a day.
Right. So the answers to questions like that would form the basis of how, these studies that you see where they're saying something like, this particular food is linked to reduced cancer risk or increased cancer risk or this thing or another, are based on recall studies like that. And so you get things like, cantaloupe. How often do you eat cantaloupe? Well, that may depend on the season, things like this. These can be really tricky to answer with accuracy. And yet these form the basis of so many of these conclusions. And so I would say that any sort of nutritional study that is highlighting or picking out one particular food versus another is probably something to be wary of. You want to look at the studies themselves. When you're hearing about some sort of research that's leading to a particular conclusion, you want to ask a few things. One is making sure that it was done in humans, not in lab animals. It's surprising how often studies make headlines when they are things that were just done in, say, mice. Cancer has been cured 1,000 times over in mice. If only we could, make those findings cross over to humans. So that's another one. You want to look at how large is the sample size. So many of these studies are done in just a handful of people, and those are interesting results, but we can't really know how generalizable they are. We need more than a single study. And I think that's another good takeaway, is that you don't really want to make radical changes to what you're doing based on a single study. Science sort of advances and fits and starts. It's very often wrong on the way to being correct. And so you have to be careful about putting too much credence into a single study. You need multiple studies that are sort of showing the same thing in the same direction before we can really have the kind of certainty that you need in order to change what you're doing.
So we're looking for a consensus on a particular type of behavior or sort of pattern amongst research.
I think another thing is to just look at, who is doing the research and who's funding it. So often, what I found while researching this book is that so much of the research that goes on for some of these products is not being done with an aim for truth finding, but that they're really marketing experiments. They're really looking for something, they're trying to find a claim that they can make, some sort of result that will back up a claim that they want to make. And that's sort of a very backwards way of doing science. It's not the way that it should be done. And there are a lot of ways. This is far too detailed for this short podcast here. But if anyone's interested in this, I've written extensively about these issues at 538. I can give you some links if you want to put them in the show notes. But it's very easy to design studies that sort of show what you want them to. And so you have to be really careful about looking at who funded the studies, where were they published, what were the funders. And also, you know, you have to be careful. If you see that there's one study that showed a really positive result, that may sound really, really, you know, great. But if you knew that there were five studies that were done and they were all negative results except for this one, you might look at that set of results differently. And so it's really important that you sort of take the totality of the evidence.
I suppose we could turn it on its head as well, couldn't we? Because there's, for instance, let's take the current trend for low carb, high fat. There's an awful lot of evidence and research out there that suggests that carbohydrates are really important and they must be a part of endurance athletes' routine and nutrition. But there's a growing body of evidence that low carb, high fat can work. Well, there's a growing body of anecdotal evidence, but it's not backed up by huge research studies. Now, there might be a number of reasons for that. One, finding a population of people who are willing to submit to a long-term research plan who are within that demographic and who that they can measure over 6 to 8 months is really difficult. There may not be the funding. We know that there's funding for carbohydrate research because people like Gatorade and PowerBar and all of those have got the funds to finance it and to get the research done, but there's not really any big nutritional companies that are promoting the low carb, high fat thing. So maybe there's no funds to do that. So a lack of evidence equally doesn't mean that something doesn't work. It just means that perhaps the research hasn't been done yet.
Yeah, that's right. With the low carb, high fat diet. So there has been some interesting research done by Louise Burke. She's from Australia. And in fact, I was just at the American College of Sports Medicine meeting in which she was discussing some of this research. And so she put a group of race walkers on this diet and was really one takeaway, I think, from the research I've seen on these diets is that they're actually very hard for people to adhere to. A lot of people that think they're doing these aren't actually doing them to the extent that they're supposed to. And this is an issue in a lot of dietary studies like this. What happens is over time, people adhere to them much less. And so you end up with two groups that actually look a lot more similar because you have one group that's sort of low fat and one group that's sort of low carb, but they're sort of going back towards the middle. But these athletes, these race walkers that were on the low carb, high fat diets were really quite miserable on them as Louise Burke describes it anyway. And so they had a hard time and they found it very difficult to perform on these diets. But when they went off, their performances really, some of them were setting PRs and having their life best performances. So there's a lot of question here, but she has not found any way. And this was in a situation where they were really controlling the diet and were able to make sure that people were really sticking to it. It was certainly not performance enhancing in those endurance athletes. But there again, you know, these are just smallish studies. I think we could sure use a lot more evidence to reach definitive conclusions.
It's interesting because I've discussed that study before and I've listened to Louise Burke and her husband John Hawley present at some conferences about that very study. And a point was made to me by somebody else that race walking, I think they were talking about 5 or 10K distances they were doing.
Yeah.
So quite high intensity, probably 30 to 35 minutes max for their effort. But that's a small population and it doesn't bear any resemblance, for instance, to triathletes who are going to be racing over 7 or 8 hours where the intensity is going to be much lower. And so, I'm not seeking to argue with you. Just that again, you need to find the right research for the type of event and program you want to follow as well.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right, and I think that there's a lot of research yet to be done. And look, there are people on both sides of this issue who believe so strongly, and I think that beliefs in any direction on these diets are really outpacing the quality of the evidence that we have right now. And so I think that the danger here is, you know, we need to keep open minds because I don't think that we have definitive evidence yet, or we don't have enough to really answer a lot of the outstanding questions. And so we need to be wary of people who are overstating the state of the evidence at this moment.
Christy, I'm aware that you have other commitments today, so I want to whiz on to some of the other things. In your research, did it confirm what you thought you already knew before you started writing the book, or did you uncover some surprising new evidence, either that contradicted what you thought you believed or that really backed it up, but that you weren't aware of?
I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, look, at the end of the day, what I found is that the basics, the things I already knew, were in fact the most important things, and the things that really were the correct things to focus on, and the ways that I could really enhance and improve and optimize recovery. But I think that I was also a little bit surprised in that I really expected that some of these newfangled things would be a lot more effective than they were. And what I found that was surprising, but also kind of interesting to me, I have a whole chapter in the book on placebos. And what I found is that a lot of the things, when they're working through a placebo effect or an expectation effect, as I like to think of it. And that is, you know, if you expect that something's going to make you feel better, that expectation can actually alter and influence your very, you know, real experience of that thing. So if I do some sort of thing and I expect that the next day I will feel less sore, then the next day when I wake up and I'm sort of assessing myself, okay, how sore do I feel? If I'm already expecting to feel less sore, I probably will experience some of that. And this is particularly true on subjective matters like this. And so that was sort of an interesting finding. And you know, there's some other interesting things too. There's good research showing that painful placebos are more effective than inert ones. And so I think that, you know, this really makes me think of ice baths, which are pretty painful. And so you get the sense that like, oh, I can tell that it's working because it hurts so much. So therefore it must be really powerful. It explains a lot. But I think there's one other big takeaway that I think I had not expected. And that is that, you know, at its most basic level, recovery is really rest and relaxation. And so anything, whether it's a ritual, a device, a service offered, you know, massage, whatever it is, if there is something that's helping you relax, that's making you feel, you know, more comfortable, more at ease, more relaxed, that's working. And so we get kind of caught up in all of these physiological things, and people are measuring, you know, blood lactate, or there's a lot of talk about lactic acid, which it turns out like that's not really important because lactic acid isn't what makes you sore, and your muscles actually clear it quite fast. So you don't really need to worry about it after the workout. But really, you know, we put all this attention on these sorts of things, but really the thing that is maybe worth paying more attention to and thinking, you know, more seriously about is just how can I relax? And for me, what is the best way for me to feel relaxed and to, you know, put those stresses away? You know, to the body, stress is stress, whether it's coming from a workout or from life stress. And I think that athletes just too often neglect to consider the effect that their life stress has on their training and their recovery. If you're really stressed in your life outside of training, that's going to impede your ability to recover. It's going to reduce the amount of training that you can absorb. And so, you know, you may have a day where you're not training hard, but if you're under a lot of stress, your body's not going to be able to take as much training. It just can't.
That point you make there is very similar to one that Phil Maffetone made in a podcast I did with him recently, where he was talking about heat stress and how when athletes are exposed to heat and mm-hmm. they haven't acclimatized, you have to reduce the training volume. So he was talking about typically some runners that he was working with in New York, and in the mm-hmm. summer it gets very hot and humid. So we always used to have a lower volume period there to allow the body space to recover when climactic conditions were causing the stress. Equally, if a coach was to look at an athlete who had a busy period of time at work, pushing for deadlines, or within the family, they'd got a new arrival and the baby was keeping them up awake, you know, awake at night, you have to adjust the training down a little bit to make space for that new stress, because the total size of the stress bucket is always the same and you can fill it how you like. But once it's overfilled and that's it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay. You talked about lactic acid there. And I know there's some athletes that buy these little monitors that measure their lactic acid in the blood to see whether they're recovered. Did you, in your book, did you touch on any ways of measuring recovery at all? And did you come up with any interesting findings there?
Yeah. The most effective measure of recovery is actually mood, it turns out. You know, athletes who are overtrained or under-recovered tend to have a depressed mood. They can get kind of cranky. They may not feel like training. This is actually the most powerful predictor of overtraining, in fact, which is, I think that was surprising to me. I expected that there was some measure that you could look at on your sports watch or something like, you know, HRV is something that's gotten a lot of attention lately. It's something that can be useful, but it's not at all definitive. And I think, yeah, there's a danger here to sort of outsourcing our tracking of recovery to some sort of measure or, you know, something on your watch or a number that you can track, because, you know, recovery is sort of, you know, it's something that you need to be able to understand and feel for yourself. One of the most important skills that any athlete can develop is an ability to read their own body and to sort of understand the signs, their individual signs of what it feels like to be recovered, what it feels like to be under too much strain. And you know, in the book, I talk about, all of these, I have a whole chapter actually about measures of recovery and different ways of tracking it. And I talk about one coach who had spent a lot of time using AI, trying to track and find, you know, the one measure that he could use in his athletes to look for overtraining. And what he found is that every athlete had some sign that would turn up that would be, you know, telling them, look, you've gone too far, you need to rest. But those signs were very individual. There wasn't one thing that was universal among athletes, but for any individual athlete, they would have a particular sign. And so every athlete has to figure out for themselves what that sign is.
So what you say there about mood, that's, I think Dr. Kelly Starrett, who's written Supple Leopard, he talks about motivation to train and mood there being the biggest indicator. Dan Plews and Paul Larson, who've done a lot of work on heart rate variability and work with HRV for training, whilst they believe heavily in that particular methodology, Dan also says, listen, Simon, when you get up in the morning, if your heart rate variability is good, but you don't feel like training, it's probably best to listen to your body rather than your gadget.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I just have to mention here really quick, I need to go in a moment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Christy, I've got some quick fire questions for you then before we finish.
Okay.
So let's just go through these, right, to finish off.
Sure.
So these are all of the methods I can think of that people that use as recovery. So all it needs from you is a yes or a no.
Okay.
as a great way of recovering. So sleep?
Yes, 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 yes.
Meditation?
Yes.
Power naps?
Yes.
Stretching?
No.
Chocolate milk after training?
Sure.
Acupuncture?
Maybe. Probably not.
We talked about ice baths, and that was a no.
Yeah.
Cryo chambers?
No.
Compression tights?
They're good placebos.
And the compression boots, the inflatable things like Normatec and et al.
Yeah, same thing. If they help you relax, sure.
Okay. Massage?
Same thing. If it helps you relax, go for it.
Okay, and I guess that would be the same for that cupping fad that came around after last Olympics.
Yeah, except I think cupping is you know, you're basically giving yourself bruises. So it's one that, you know, if it helps you relax, maybe, but it's really not beneficial, and it's sort of giving you a bat. It's not good.
Okay, foam rolling, you mentioned?
I have a whole section on that. It's more complicated than yes or no. Maybe.
Okay. EMS, electromuscular stimulation.
That's another maybe.
Okay, sauna.
this is another if it helps you relax.
Okay, hot cold therapy. So going in the sauna, then going in the plunge pool.
Yeah, it's only if it makes you feel better, but probably not.
Okay, low intensity activity, going for a walk in the woods, riding your bike with your friend really easily.
Yes.
NSAIDs was a definite no.
Yeah.
Any nutrition that will definitely help with recovery?
I mean, it's more nuanced than that. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I would just tell people to read the book because I think it's much more interesting than just yes or no answers. And I think that reading the book will help people really walk away with a better sense of being able to assess things and to figure out for themselves what the best approach is.
Okay, Christy, I understand you have to go now. So let's try and give people a quick heads up on where they can find your book. And you mentioned in our chat several times, 538. Is that the name of your website?
No, 538, up until a few months ago, I was the lead science writer there. It's a data journalism site in the US. It's the number spelled out 538.com. My website is my name, ChristyAshwandan.com, but people can find out more about the book by going to www.goodtogobook.com.
Okay. Those are the best places to follow you. Anything on Instagram or Facebook?
Yeah. So on all of those, Instagram and Twitter, I am at Crag Crest. That's CRAGCREST. It's a place name. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you very much for being a guest. I'm really, really pleased that somebody's taken the lead and written about recovery. Hopefully, the listeners will get onto this and read your book, find out more about it. If they want to find out more about you and dig a bit deeper into what you've done and maybe ask you some questions, they can go and find you on social media. And hopefully, you'll get a lot more interest about recovery. I know I'm definitely more interested in it. So,
great.
Christy, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Listeners, thanks for being here again. That was Christy Ashwandan. For now, enjoy the rest of your week and thanks for listening. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose. And for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.